ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is the amazing Paul Jarvis, a great designer, a great author, and the founder of multiple things and author of multiple books. And we're going to talk about trust marketing today. This episode is brought to you by Tiny Reminder, a simple productivity tool for freelancers and consultants. Need content or files on time? Tiny Reminder will play bad cop for you with friendly notifications. It works great for collecting content, feedback, files, bios, or anything else. What's best, this tool is forever free. Sign up today at tinyreminder.com. Hey, Paul.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing great. Thank you for making it today. I admire everything you do, and it's amazing to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much.
So we're going to start with a short questionnaire so that in case someone doesn't know who you are, they're going to have an idea.
Perfect.
And question number one is, what do you do for a living?
That question is so hard. I wish it was easier. So right now, I write, mostly what I do is writing and design. So I write articles every week for my newsletter, the Sunday Dispatches. They're syndicated across a whole bunch of business publications. I also write books and courses. And then the design aspect of things is I design products, mostly software and WordPress plugins, so SaaS apps and WordPress plugins. So that's kind of the bulk of it. I also have two podcasts. I also do a whole bunch of other stuff. I wish I had a good way to sum up what I do, but I don't, and I end up just rambling like I just did.
So you're a man of multiple trades.
Yes.
All right. Then question number two is, how did you get there?
So I'm old. So I was in university in the 90s for computer science and artificial intelligence. And then I realized that school wasn't right for me. I was bored, and I didn't feel like I was learning very much. So I quit school, and I got a job at an agency as a designer, then as a creative director. And then I realized that a job wasn't for me, and I was like, oh no, okay, school isn't for me, and jobs aren't for me. What the hell am I going to do? So I quit that job, and I was going to look for another job, because I thought maybe it was just the fact that my boss was a jerk. So I was going to look for another job, but then the day I quit, I was actually going to go to the library to look up how to write a resume, because the internet didn't really have, it had like four pages on it at the time. So the library was like the slow version of the internet, where Googling was just like going to find a book. So I was going to go look up how to write a resume, because I'd never written a resume. But I started to get calls from clients of that agency that I just quit. And they were like, hey, Paul, where are you going to go? We'll just bring our work to you, because we liked working with you more than the agency that you were working at. And then after, I think, probably like three calls or so, a light bulb went off in my head. And I was like, hey, why don't I just work with these people on my own? So I kind of became an entrepreneur and a freelancer by accident. This was 20 years ago.
So wow.
after that day, I started working with these clients and then getting more clients. And then really just freelancing for about 15 or so years. Then I decided to start writing books and courses and software and all of that. But that's kind of like, that's the origin story, I think, of Paul Jarvis.
Interesting. You look so young. Is this because of you're eating the right food?
Exactly. I'm vegan and I don't eat gluten and I don't drink. So I basically have no fun with what I consume. But yeah, I do look young.
Awesome. I had a question from early years when I've been following you. You have pretty amazing clients among your portfolio. Like few famous internet ladies. I don't know, you call them yourself. But how did you really land those projects?
Yeah, so I actually started out doing websites for pro sport athletes, which sounds really cool, and like I would get tickets to games and stuff, but I hate sports. So like I niched down and I was really good at like doing websites for pro athletes. The only problem was I hated it. And athlete agents are the people that I would have to deal with, because they're like the managers of the athletes, and they're assholes for a living. Like their job is to be the worst person in the world for their clients. So their client gets everything they want because they're basically raise a stink about everything. So it was, the work sucked, even though it, like, on the surface, it's like, oh, it seems really cool. You're working with all these athletes and getting tickets to games and stuff. But I that did teach me that, like, niching down was really important. Like, it's really hard to stand out as a web designer on the internet. It's easier to stand out as, like, a web designer for this group of people, because then you get known in that group of people, and then people in that group start to say, like, oh, I see this website, I see this guy designed it. If he designs websites like that, and I'm a person like that, then maybe I should hire him. And the same kind of happened with the niche that I ended up with, which was women entrepreneurs who are basically their own brand, like Danielle Laporte, Marie Forleo, Chris Carr, those sorts of women. So super smart business women that their name and themselves are their brand, and that's how they do business. And so I started working with a couple of them, and then more started to notice, and then I started to work with more of them. And then when your name is on the bottom of sites like Marie Forleo or Danielle Laporte or Chris Carr, then everybody that's similar in that industry is like, well, Paul is a guy that's designing sites for these women, and they are, like, the absolute leaders in this field. Then he's the person that I want to talk to first, instead of, I'm not, because really what you want as a freelancer is the person that's in your niche not to just go to the internet and look up, like, find web designer. You want them to be like, I want to hire the person that did this person's website. So I'm not competing with the rest of the internet. It's just, they know they want to work with me specifically, so I'm really just competing with myself. And I know I can win in that situation. I know I can land clients in that situation.
Yeah, I know it's actually the magic of niching down to a certain group of people, the magic of positioning or stuff like that.
Exactly.
What does your typical day look like?
I don't have, like, there is no typical day. So I always wake up in the morning. That's pretty typical. I get up, like, probably around 5 or 6. No alarm clock. I haven't really had an alarm clock for decades. I don't believe in them. I'd rather just sleep till I'm done sleeping. But I always wake up early. And I think that as well has to do with my diet and the fact that I read before bed instead of watching TV or something like that. I always have a coffee, and then I typically meditate for about 5-10 minutes, but after that, whatever needs doing. Like, I usually think of, like, one or two things I want to accomplish for the day and then work at that. Like, if I can't remember my to-do list in my head, then my to-do list is too long or it's not important enough to remember. And then I always try to stop work around 4. I usually make dinner for my wife, so when she gets home from work, there's, like, a home-cooked meal on the table.
Oh, yeah. That's so nice.
Awesome. I'm basically the best.
Right.
But yeah, like, I really like cooking, and it feels like it's really focused, and I'll usually listen to, like, a podcast or something while I'm cooking, but I like turning, like, just whole ingredients into, like, a finished meal. It feels like I'm launching something every single day from taking, like, pieces and then making it into, like, something cohesive. So yeah, that's about it. But really, like, some days I write, some days I design, some days I talk on the phone all day, some days I go for a hike for the entire day. Like, there's no schedule, there's no routine. It's just kind of whatever needs doing gets done.
Please correct me if I'm wrong. Your first book was a cookbook.
Yeah, it was a cookbook called Eat Awesome, which is the worst name ever. But it was still, yeah, that was still my first book.
Could you give us an overview? I know you've had, like, a dozen awesome projects over the last few years. Could you give us a recap of those?
Yeah, so the first book I wrote was Eat Awesome. Then I wrote an online business book called Be Awesome at Online Business. The names for these, Jane, were so bad in the beginning. But so I wrote Be Awesome at Online Business because I wanted to attract more of the type of clients that I like working with. So I wrote a book specifically for them. And this, again, speaks to positioning and niching. So I found the niche that I wanted, but I wanted to position myself as an expert in that niche. So I wrote a book specifically for those people. And the good thing about books is anybody can write a book and publish a book. And then it kind of, there's this, like, status symbol, like, oh, if you've written a book on this subject, you must be an expert, even if you're not. It doesn't matter. It still feels like that. After that, I wrote a couple more books. Then I started to get into courses. So my first course was Creative Class, which teaches freelancers the business side of freelancing, so the sales and the processes and the systems and the marketing end. And then I launched a course for MailChimp, then a course to like build trust and grow audiences. And then I have a bunch of software products too. I have a WordPress plugin for courses called WP Complete. I just sold a company called Of Course Books, which was interactive.
Oh my God, you sold it?
Yeah. Oh.
Sorry, I didn't know. I thought it's like on the blossoming side.
It is, but I didn't have the time, myself and the other two founders, Zach and Jason, we didn't have the time to fully invest in that project. So we found somebody that did, and luckily they wanted to buy it off of us. So there's going to be a lot more happening with that software now that we aren't involved anymore, because somebody can focus specifically on that. So I do a lot of things. I'm also writing a book right now that'll be traditionally published probably in about 2 years, because traditional publishing takes forever to happen. So I have a lot of projects and stuff, and those are just the main ones. And those are just the ones that worked. There's a bunch that didn't work.
Awesome. Can you give us a hint what the published book is going to be about?
Yeah, it's about growing a business without growing a business. So growing things like profits or happiness or enjoyment in a business without having to hire a ton of employees or get an office space or like increase expenses. So it's basically the Paul Jarvis business model of growing a business without growing. So I make more money every year, but I don't spend more time on my business, or I don't hire people. Like, I don't have anybody working for me. I just have a couple freelancers that I work with when I need to. So that's the unless a publisher changes it completely, which I doubt they will, that's kind of where the book's at and what the topic is.
Yeah, this model of staying small and sustainable, it resonates so much with me. That's exactly how I want my life to go, because cool. It doesn't entail any organizational burden upon your life.
Exactly. I think that's true for a lot of people. A lot of us got into the work that we do not so we could manage people, but just so we could do awesome work. And having a company of one, as I call it, really enables you to just focus on the work side of things and not the managing side of things, and not the like, okay, I got to have like 3 meetings today. I got to meet with my staff. I got to talk to them. I got to give them marching orders. Like, no, just do the work.
Exactly. So next question, what do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I think what I enjoy the most is just doing it. Like, if left to my own devices, like even on the weekends, like I like working. Like, I like writing. I like writing code. I like designing things. I like figuring out how to solve people's problems, which is really what products are. And I think what I like the least is just the, like, it's a slog. Like, you can love the work you do, but not love the trappings of that work. And what I mean by that is, some days, like if there's a bug in the code and I can't figure it out, it's frustrating. Or like if I'm trying to design something and the design looks like crap, then it's frustrating. Or if I have somebody that needs support and they're really angry about it and like mean about it, then it's frustrating. So there's definitely lots of things. Like, just because I think I have the best job in the entire world doesn't mean I love it every second of every day, or it doesn't mean that I only do it when I feel like inspired to do it. It's a job. And I think a lot of people don't treat their work, if they're a freelancer, if they're a creative, they think they treat it like a job, and I don't think they do. And I think that's not the best thing that they could be doing for their life or for their work. And I treat it like I wake up in the morning, I get up early, I get to work. I don't care if I'm inspired. I don't care if I'm motivated. I just like, I get up, I sit down, I figure out what needs doing, and then I work on it.
Yeah, sounds great. And since you have the liberty of setting your own goals, that most likely it will be a reasonably good goal.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I work for myself. So if my boss is an asshole, it's my fault. Like, it's 100% my fault if I don't like the goals that I have set for myself.
Exactly. What is your next big thing among the big published book and others?
That's really the next biggest thing. Like, right now it's in the like proposal phase, so it's about 60 pages long. So I still have to take it from 60 pages to like 300 pages. So that's one of the biggest things. The next thing that I'm working on is, I launched Creative Class almost 4 years ago, which seems like, it feels like I launched it yesterday, but I looked at it and I was like, holy shit, it came out in at the end of 2013, or I started beta testing it at the end of 2013. So I feel like that was the first thing that I ever taught on the internet. And I feel like since I've been doing that for 4 years, I feel like I've learned a lot about teaching, and I feel I've learned a lot about how courses work on the internet. So I'm kind of redoing, the content is staying fairly similar, but the way that I teach it in a more kind of action-oriented way is going to change. So I'm actually working on redoing the course, even though, and that's kind of one of the, it's kind of one of the things that I do. Like, the course still does well, the course still sells, but I don't feel like it's the best that it could possibly be. So I want to redo it, even though I don't have to, but I feel like I want, I feel like it's a good use of my time to make the course even better for people.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. What has changed in your teaching manner that you want to update in the course, if you're willing to go into details?
Yeah, totally. So I think a lot of, and I've been doing a lot of research on this, and people don't tend to retain information by listening to it very well, or something like 5%. There's a study done in university with lectures, and students tended on average to retain about 5% of information presented by professors in a lecture, which is ridiculous. Like, it blew my mind when I'm like, did they miss a zero? Did they miss like a one? Like, no, it was like 5%. It's like the worst stat ever. So what I'm trying to do now is incorporate, action and activities, because that can increase it to over 70%, right? So having things, and that's really why I created the software of course books, because it's like, if people are filling in these interactive workbooks, then they're doing something instead of just listening to me yammer on. So I'm trying to build in like exercises and activities into everything, but I'm also trying to teach more through examples, because I find that it's good to kind of lay down the theory, but that doesn't really need to take that long, especially if you, and I've also found that there's a difference between being able to know, like having knowledge about a subject and being able to teach that subject. So I'm very knowledgeable about freelancing because I've done it for 2 decades. Like, I know freelancing inside and out, but teaching freelancing is fairly new. And the first time I did it, I was new to teaching on the internet. So now I feel like just the way that I talk and going a bit slower than I was in the beginning, giving more examples, giving more things that people can work on or think about, I think that's really going to help. And just making it more of a cohesive process instead of just like, here's a bunch of lessons you can do. I want to turn it into a system that people can take and remember. So once they've done all the lessons and they've watched like an hour or two of lessons, they can get a PDF and it just kind of covers what they've learned, and they can just keep referring back to it and like, okay, I'm at this step in the process, or I'm at this step in the process, and then move forward. Because really, like, the main reason I make courses is to make money. The second reason that I make courses is because I want people to take that information and use it. Like, it doesn't feel like it's a successful course if people are buying it but then not doing anything. Like, if nobody was bettering their freelance business after taking the freelance course, it would have made me a bunch of money, but I wouldn't feel very good because it's like, well, nobody did anything, right? So I always want people to be able to get something out of it that they can take and implement and make better. And that's like what I like to hear the most about my courses is when people are like, hey, I took your course and like I increased my freelancing rate by 250%, or I figured out how to do MailChimp and I'm now making like 50% more revenue because my lists are so much more targeted. Like, that kind of stuff feeds me to keep going with courses. And like, the making money side of it is great, but like, that doesn't sustain me. Like, making, like, I like making money, but like, if it was just the money, I'd probably do something else. Whereas when people are like taking the courses and learning from them and then doing something about it based on what they've learned, that's really what drives me. Like, that's what keeps me going, because that's that's the best.
Absolutely. Are you going to be using your course books for your own course?
Yeah, probably. I still mm-hmm. I still have an admin account, so I still basically have free access to it.
Oh, amazing!
So I can't see why not.
Right. Now let's proceed to our main topic: trust marketing. You stand as a big online figure because you're pretty unique in the way you build your audience and the way you treat it and the way you design your site and everything. And it looks like you decided to make a course about it. How to teach others do the same.
Yeah.
if you were to sum up the essence of your method in a few sentences, what would they be?
Yeah, so I think that growing an audience, so I'll even back up further. I think trust is a precursor to sales, right? So in order for somebody to buy something from you, they have to trust you first. Like there's no way of getting around that. If they don't trust you, they're probably not going to buy it. It's like the last car that I bought because I trust that the manufacturer knows how to make cars. If I thought for a second that like, their brakes are kind of like 50-50, I wouldn't have bought the car. And the same goes for software. The same goes for courses. It's like, if you don't trust the person who's selling you the thing that they're selling you, you're not going to open up your wallet. So I'm very strategic in the way that the way that I work trust into my brand and into the way that I communicate. So the first thing that I do is I communicate with my audience often. Like I communicate with them every single Sunday. I write a new article. I send it to my list every Sunday. There are no exceptions. I don't miss a Sunday, except when I take November and December off usually because I hate the holidays and it's people are getting too many emails in anyways. So I found that marketing really comes down to four things. And I just talked about the first thing, which was trust. So marketing is building trust and empathy with a specific group of people by communicating with them consistently or as consistently as possible. So trust has to happen. And trust is really just you being yourself and you being transparent and you doing things that you know how to do. Right. So like me saying like, oh yeah, I'll build you a car, Jane. I don't know how to build a car. So, like, there would be no trust because I would like design a website for a car and that's what you would get, thinking that you could drive it when really it's just a website. So the next thing is empathy. So yeah, marketing is building trust and empathy. So empathy is listening to and noticing things with your audience so you can feel with them. So understanding where they're at, what their pains are, and how they want to solve them and what motivates them to solve them. So being able to listen, and I think this is real, like, it sounds so stupid, but like listening is such an underused skill in our world. So the reason why the biggest thing that I get from my email, from my newsletter, is people saying like, it's like you were listening to my thoughts and you wrote this article just for me. And I don't have telepathy. It would be cool if I could use telepathy. Then I'd be like the best marketer ever. But like, I listen to what my audience is saying and I notice what they're struggling with because I talk to them. And then I can write things for them and then I can make things for them. So for example, the Grow Your Audience course, I made that because I had hundreds of people asking me how I grew my own audience, right? So that's how I built it. So the third part of marketing is a specific group. And we talked about this already with freelancing, but the same applies to products. So marketing is simply building trust and empathy with a specific group of people by consistently communicating them. So the specific group of people is really just, you can't market to everyone. Like Oprah can't market to everyone, even though she's Oprah, or like Tim Ferriss or somebody like that. You have to have a group of people. You have to have something you stand for that people are going to stand. Some people are going to stand with you on that. And some people are going to be like, that person's not for me. So I have, when you sign up for my newsletter, you get this silly email about like, oh, I'm so happy you signed up for my list. I went out and got your name tattooed on me. And that turns some people off. And that's perfect because if people don't get that part of my sense of humor in my brand, they're not, like, it's just going to be a slog to try to get them to buy anything, or they're not going to be happy because I say shit in like one lesson in one of my courses. So the final thing, and I've talked about this a lot, is consistent communication. So establishing like a two-way dialogue with other people, and really like businesses, relationships, and having a two-way dialogue with people, like a newsletter that people can reply to. Like my newsletter doesn't go out from noreply@pjrvs.com. It goes out from my personal email address. So anybody that gets my email, and there's like 30,000 people on my list, like they all have my email address and they can email me, and a couple hundred people do every week. But I like hearing from people and I like replying to people because this is my audience. Like I want to get to know them. I want to be empathetic towards what they're doing and what they're struggling with. I want to build these relationships. And then commerce happens. I think that's like the longest winded answer I've ever given about trust in marketing. But that's really what the course is summed up.
I would love to hear some of that advice and the way you apply it to your own list. Because your email list is one of your biggest assets, and it's mm-hmm. huge. And I wonder how you keep it focused, because I imagine it can be pretty diverse in terms of, you know, social position. There can be designers, developers, freelancers, consultants, whoever. How do you define your target audience yourself?
Yeah, and it is pretty diverse. And I think that's where a lot of people kind of fail with, like, however you call it, like personas, defining your audience, that kind of thing. Like, people aren't one-dimensional. So when we are marketers and we start to think, like that our audience is one-dimensional, we're not doing ourselves any favors and we're not doing them any favors. So, like, my audience is made up of, like, freelancers, product people, coaches, like, designers, developers, writers. But they all kind of have the same things in common. So they have what they feel is that they want to question the way things are typically done or the way that experts say things should be done, because that's how I operate. I assume that nobody is correct and that we're all wrong all the time. Some of us are slightly less wrong than others at some times. So this idea of being challenged, because a lot of what I write is challenging. I think the last article I wrote was something like inspirational quotes on social media are ruining your life. Like, mm-hmm. I challenge people as often as possible, not because I want them to see that they're wrong, but because I want them to question whether or not they're wrong. So they have that in common. Pretty much all of them do work on the internet and then sell something on the internet, whether it's services or products. They all want to make a difference, and not just in terms of like their bank account growing, but make some kind of difference, whether it's personal or social or like just feeling better about their lives or making other people feel better about their lives. So they're not just like financially driven. They're driven by more of like a purpose or some sort of goal. So I think that's really how I define them, even though it's not like just Paul writes for designer. It becomes harder to explain and describe too, right? But it's why, and I do that on purpose, like I focus on a slightly wider audience that's more of a, like, some people from a lot of groups instead of just like a lot of people from one group, because I like to be able to write about whatever I want every week. So like every week it's a different topic. Sometimes I'm talking about writing. Sometimes I'm talking about philosophy. Sometimes I'm talking about marketing, but it always relates to something specific for my audience that my audience could get some kind of benefit or value from.
Absolutely. So it feels like your targeting is not on social profile. It's not what people do, but rather focusing on your values and the way you do business.
Yeah, it's more how people think than what people do.
Interesting. I think a lot of people don't even think about that direction. Like, the typical drill, and I do recommend the same in my books, and I'm probably wrong, as you say, is to figure out, like, I'm writing for designers, period. I don't write for developers. But you're pretty interesting in this approach.
Yeah, and it doesn't work for everything, right? Like, if you have a specific software product that's for designers, then your audience should be designers. Exactly. Right? Like, it doesn't always work. And for my courses, they're a lot more specific, but I find that for my general audience, for Paul Jarvis, the brand, not Paul Jarvis, the person, it works better if it's more, like, value-based than, like, specific, like, industry-based. Whereas when I was doing web design, it was industry-based. When I'm doing courses, it's a lot more focused, but the general audience that I have isn't. So I think both work. It just depends on what your goals are.
Mm-hmm. One of my most favorite pieces of advice is to plan your product letter strategically. So you have like different levels of advice for the same group of people focusing on the same like task. But your products over the years, they're very different. Is that intentional, or did you want to test waters in different fields, or is it just what you like to do, to work on different things?
Yeah, so I do obviously very much like to work on different things all the time. And I like to I like to figure things out and then move on to something totally different. But when you look at, say, my three biggest products, Creative Class, Chimp Essentials, and Grow Your Audience, they all completely relate, because you start off as a freelancer most of the time. You start off with services, because services are easier than products, especially in the beginning. And then So you take creative class, or if you want to take creative class, you take creative class. Then you move into hitting a ceiling for you can only do so much one-on-one work with people before you run out of time. So the amount of money you can charge can increase. Like you can charge more for the same service, but you hit a point, like you hit a ceiling where there's no way you could take on more work, or you wouldn't be happy taking on more work because there's only so many hours in the day. So you move on to one-to-many things like products. And so that's why I have a course called Grow Your Audience for people who want to move from freelancing into product making. And when you're making products, your biggest asset other than the product that you're making is your mailing list. So I have a course called Chimp Essentials for people to be smarter with their marketing. So it kind of takes people through like kind of a life cycle of their work. So they start out as a freelancer, they perhaps move into indie product development or info product development, and then they need to learn about marketing and email marketing. So they all kind of do relate. And then I have just like random side projects like my WordPress plugin. But like the main things that I do all relate to like the same, like they would work for the same person. And what I found is that the people who bought one of my courses are really, really likely to buy another one, and then really, really likely to buy all three of them. So there's a lot of people that own all three of my courses. And I find that it's easier to market to people who have bought one of the courses because they're way, way, way more likely to buy more of them. So it is definitely intentional, but sometimes it is just me wanting to do something totally different.
Okay, got it. I didn't even realize it's so closely related to each other.
Yeah.
Because they seem to be attacking different skills, but yeah, not exactly different.
It's different skills for the same type of person.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
I love your concept of gravy. It's about, like, what I learned over years is that whatever you do, it's always hard to make people just do anything online. It's hard to get people convert, sign up, buy. And you have that concept of gravy. Can you please elaborate on that?
Yeah, so I expect very little of everything that I do. I expect that a bare minimum will happen. So my first book, I think I hope that I sold 12 copies. 12 seems real. Like, I'm pretty sure I know 12 people that can buy a vegan cookbook that is full of nut jokes. Or with like creative class, the first course that I launched, I hoped maybe I'll make a few $1,000 over a year, which will help because at the time I was a freelancer and I was making good money freelancing, but I was just like, maybe there's some extra money and my wife and I can like just go on like a week longer vacation with a couple grand more. And what I found is that having low expectations is good because anything beyond that is what I call gravy. So anything beyond that feels like it's just extra. It's just a bonus. So whereas a lot of people are like, oh, I want my book to be like a best-selling book. Well, that's hard. Like, I have a bunch of best-selling books. That's hard. And that's like, I don't even know if I couldn't do that every time. Like, there's so many little things that go into having a best-selling book that a lot of it is just working at things and hoping they work out. And same with like, I want to have like a six-figure launch of my course or my product, which is hard. Like, it's very hard. Like, I've had six-figure launches and I still don't do that every time because it's hard. So if you set yourself up for this, like, I want to have this like massive launch and I'm a failure unless I hit that, then all of these out of control things are just going to make you feel bad about it. When really, like, if I have a product and if one person gets some benefit from it, then that's awesome. If like 100 people get some benefit from it, that's cool too. If 1,000 people, that's just gravy. Like, it's just extra. And gravy is really just extra. It makes the meal taste better, but like the meal should still taste good without the gravy. The gravy is just like a bonus. So I kind of always approach things like that. Otherwise, like if something failed, then I would just feel so bad. Or if I feel like it's a failure, unless it hits this massive goal, which is so out of my control anyways, like as soon as you launch something, it's basically out of your control because there's like a billion tiny little things that need to go right for quote unquote success to happen, that I think a lot of us need to like set things a bit more reasonable. Like if I sell a couple courses when I launch something, or if I cover my costs when I launch something, then that's good. If it does better than that, then that's bonus. That's gravy. That's extra.
Yes, absolutely. I love the the idea of internet products by itself, because it's like a big experimental lab where you just push something and see if it works. And really, it's not your fault, not your failure or something. It's just a combination of multiple little factors. And some people might have their card lying on the table that night. Some people might not. And you can increase the odds, but you can never be sure. And it's amazing to be experimental, not like upset about the failure.
Exactly. And experiments mean that you sometimes have to run them more times. Like a lot of my launches have done better like the fourth time I've launched the same thing, or like the second time, because like you launch something, you guess at everything, then you start to learn things, you start to collect data, and then you can launch a second time with less guesses and more data. And then the third time you can launch with even less guesses and more data. So I find that I kind of hit my stride with products, not like the first launch, but like the second or the third or the fourth. Whereas a lot of people are like, I just spent like months and months building this thing. So I'm going to tell my mailing list once. I'm going to tweet it once. I'll maybe put it on Facebook. And if I don't have like $100,000 in sales, then it's a failure. And I don't get that, because like I'll launch something once and it'll sell a little bit, but then I'll launch it again and it'll sell more. Then I'll launch it again and it'll sell more. Like every time Chimp Essentials launches twice a year, every time I launch Chimp Essentials, I make the same amount of money. So if I'd only launched it once, I wouldn't have made four times with me launching it four times. So I wouldn't have 4x the revenue on that simply by launching it four times. And I just keep launching it over and over again. Same with all my stuff. I launch it over and over again because the first time is like a guess, and then you start to learn a lot more. You start to see what people want or what they don't want. I even ask people why they don't buy my products, right? Because like I want, like that to me is so much more interesting than why somebody does buy. Like why they do buy is important, but like I just sent out an email to like 3,000 people on the Chimp Essentials non-buyer segment, just like, hey, why didn't you buy this? I worded it a lot better than that, but like that's interesting to me. Like that shows me like what I can do better, what I can change in the positioning or the wording or the marketing or the video. So like I'm always trying to learn and experiment and figure out like what works, what doesn't work.
Since you launched things so many times, how does your idea of a perfect launch, of a typical launch, look like?
If nothing big breaks, like, really, it's a success if like the site doesn't go down. Like that to me, like if the site stays online, I've moved all my hosting to more cloud-based stuff. Because like if you send an email to like tens of thousands of people, a lot of those people are going to go to your website all at the same time, right? So
right.
Like things can slow down, or like payment processing can like slow down. So having a good server and good infrastructure is always important. Not having a typo in the URL is also a win, because I've done that before. I sent out an email to like 20,000 people and there was like a typo in, I put like .com instead of .co. And like, here, buy my course. Oh, wait, the URL doesn't work. The URL points to something else. So yeah, for me, like a successful launch is really just like, if nothing big goes wrong, like things are always going to go wrong. And so I'm not looking for perfection in a launch ever, because that's never going to happen. So there's going to be like a typo in the launch email, or there's going to be like one person out of 1,000 who can't, whose credit card gets bounced by the bank because I'm technically in Canada. So even though I charge in US dollars, it's a foreign currency exchange. So a lot of banks, especially in America, think that, oh, maybe this is fraud. So the payment's not going to go through. So like things like that happen. And I do things like auto dunning. So if a payment fails, then they get an email with a link to PayPal. But like, if nothing major breaks, like if thousands of people want to buy something and they aren't able to do it, then that's not a successful launch. But if like most things go right most of the time, then I'm happy. I don't care about like specific numbers or specific people or this or that. Like if nothing breaks, I'm happy.
Right, right. I was actually expecting a different kind of answer. Like I send out 10 emails prior to the launch,
I totally do.
So, stuff like that, the actual structure.
Oh yeah. So I basically like the launch email is the end. Like the launch email is a final step in launching a product. Like I start emailing people who are interested based on the segments in my mailing list. I start emailing people months before. Let's look at Grow Your Audience for a sec. So I had the idea to build a course for people growing their mailing list. And then I realized you can't grow a mailing list without traffic. You can't grow traffic without having a niche being thought of as an expert. So it kind of went back. I was like, shit, you just got to grow like your entire audience. And I had the course was going to be called Trust Marketing, but then I did a survey for my audience. And most people said, and I was talking about, like, what do you want to learn about marketing? What do you struggle with? And pretty much everybody said, I want to know how to grow my audience. So then the name of the course was Grow Your Audience. Then I started dropping hints about the course, about Grow Your Audience, to people. And then I sent out an email to people that I segmented based on if they said in that survey that they would possibly buy a course on marketing from me. So I invited just those people to beta test it. Like, the next 20 people can buy the course for like half price or something like that, and they can beta test it. Then I got beta testers involved. Then I started, like, so there's like 6 months of me talking to my audience about something before I launch it. So on launch day, all I need to do is say, like, hey everybody, that thing that I've been talking about for like months and months and months, you know about it already. You already know everything you need to know about it. I've written articles about why it's important. I've told you about it. I've mentioned beta testing. I've surveyed you. I've listened to you. You can buy it now. And like, that's why my sales emails are typically really short. It's like, hey, Grow Your Audience is now available. And that'll be like the sales email. Because I've spent months and months kind of building it up and kind of working towards the launch. So on launch day, all I need to do is say, like, hey, it's ready. Because you already know everything about it, but you can now buy it.
Yeah, that's a great strategy. That's the only right strategy, probably, because the typical mistake people do is working vice versa, sending something out and then like trying to mend things by proceeding with sales, but they don't work.
Nobody wants to buy something the first time they hear about it.
Right.
Like, it doesn't work that way. You need to build trust about that thing first. So me writing articles about marketing and growing your audience and using a strategy versus like a bunch of discombobulated tactics, that's all building trust for when I do launch the strategy that I use for like building my products and my audience and all of that. Then people are like, he's been talking about this for a while. Like, he knows what he's talking about. I know why it's important for me to learn this. It's available. Maybe I should buy it right this second.
Yeah, absolutely. One final question, because we need to wrap it up. I know we could talk about this forever, but you're a designer. I'm a designer, and there is a whole lot of designers listening to us today. And you're pretty unique in your design style. You're brave to, you know, take all the frills and pretty stuff out and leaving just bare essentials. How did you grow up to that?
So I've always been like a minimalist in life, in design. Like, I've always loved that aesthetic. Like, I've designed sites that aren't minimal, and that's totally fine. Like, clients, I like to collaborate. But what I found, like, for my personal site, a lot of that was A-B testing. So testing, like, okay, what's going to... Because all I care about on my site is conversion rate to my mailing list. I don't care about anything else. I don't care about shares, comments. So I just ran a whole bunch of A-B tests, like, how many signups do I get if I do this? How many signups do I get if I do this? How many? And then I just kept noticing, like, as I took more and more stuff off of my site, more and more people were signing up for the mailing list. So I just kept removing stuff, and now, like, I don't even have a navigation bar at the top of my site. Like, I can't remove any more stuff without it just being like a white screen with like a sign up box. So it is definitely an aesthetic that I love. Like, I really, really love simple and lots of white space, but it's also a strategy that I've tested that works for the goals that I have in my business, which is conversions to subscribers.
Right. Because there are different types of minimalism. One is that you get a site where, you know, there is blank screen and a pretty circle or a dot running around and some hidden menu or stuff like that. But your minimalism is the one I enjoy really, because it's useful. It's utilitarian. It converts.
Yeah, it's not an art project. It's really based on, and this is really how I differentiated myself as a web designer and why I got hired for pretty much every project. Like, every potential client that came to me, I pretty much like got the job because I focused on the business aspect of design. And luckily, the industry for design is changing, and people, like, design is becoming more of a lead role in business decisions. But it wasn't always like that. And designers were really just thought of as like hired monkeys, like, hey, go build this exactly like this. Whereas I always approach design as like, how can I use the visual language that I know how to speak to better your business. And that's really how I got a lot of jobs as a web designer. And that's how I get my products to sell, because I approach design as like the solution to business problems. So I figure out, okay, what's the problem? Maybe it's like not a very high conversion rate. So how can I solve that with visuals? How can I solve that with design? How can I test the ideas that I have and then implement those things? So solving problems with design, solving business problems with design has really, really, really helped me.
Yep. Paul, it's time to say, where can people find you online?
Google Paul Jarvis is the easiest
way. All right.
My mailing list, like really, like Sunday Dispatches is the best place to keep up with like everything I do and to read articles that I write every week. And from there, like I talk about the products I launch, but really just like Google my name, you'll find whatever part of me you want to consume, like whether it's Twitter, podcast, newsletter, whatever. Yeah.
I'm going to do the dirty work and Google it for people so that I can actually write down links for folks.
PJRBS.com. Nobody remembers right. that. It's like the worst URL ever, but I use it on purpose just to show that URLs don't really matter.
Okay. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your wisdom. It was awesome. And I wish you good luck with all of your new projects.
Thanks, Jane.
And have a great day.
You too.